What are the most popular things to come out of Denmark? You might be surprised.
I went to a conference where somebody from the Nordic Ethics Committee showed a slide and he said these are Danish export products. Beer, Lego and sperm.
I'm Kate Bryan. Stay with me here on the BBC World Service as I try to find out why the third of these products is in such demand in the new Vikings.
What's the big attraction of Danish sperm?
The blonde hair and the blue eyes, the cheekbones as well, I think.
We quite look up to them. The Danes are seen as a solid and dependable people.
Do you think about the number of children there may be who are a result of your donation?
I can make hundreds.
100 children out there.
200.
So is it the Danish conquest of the world?
The second one after the Vikings?
They've invaded us once by boat and now they're doing it by sperm.
Let the Vikings rule Europe.
In many countries, not just in Europe, there's a huge demand for donor sperm. Growing numbers of single women and lesbian couples are keen to have children. And of course, there are always heterosexual couples who aren't able to do so without help, despite advances in fertility treatments. In the UK, since 2005, the number of registered donors has been rising. But more than twice as many donors now come from overseas, and increasingly from Denmark. Why Denmark? My attempt to find out begins in London, where perhaps the first question should be, why are so few men donating here in the UK? This is up for discussion at a meeting at the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists.
I'm Dr. Alan Pacey. I am a fertility expert at the University of Sheffield, and I'm also the current chairman of the British Fertility Society. I think it simply is that we don't have enough donors in the UK to meet the national need.
So what's our problem? Why can't we have more donors here?
I think there are a number of problems. We simply don't have the clinic infrastructure sufficiently well organised to recruit donors, even when men want to donate. Very often there just simply isn't the size and scale within small NHS clinics to consider having a donor recruitment operation. Plus, if you're not confident that sufficient numbers of men are going to ring up and offer to be sperm donors, the economics of it simply isn't going to work. And the NHS is used to treating patients, and you get a fee for treating patients. You don't get a fee for screening a donor that you may not ultimately accept. So it's quite a big ask for some NHS clinics to take on, I call it a burden, of screening and recruiting donors.
Until recently, UK donors could be anonymous. But this changed in 2005, when donor-conceived people's right to know about their genetic heritage was recognised. This now means they can make contact with their donors once they turn 18.
Jane Stewart's a consultant at the Newcastle Fertility Centre. Jane, didn't this change suddenly put a lot of men off becoming donors?
We've long thought that perhaps it was to do with the change in the anonymity rules. I think people are pretty reasonably happy that that's not just the story now. We had a problem in Newcastle specifically where we had to shelve our anonymous donors when the anonymity rules changed. And although we had recruited for known donation prior to that, it was taking us a long time to make up the shortfall. I think we've probably plateaued now, but we still have a waiting list which we never had before.
I've been writing and reporting about fertility for almost 20 years now, and I've often come across people who've been told that they'd have to wait some years for a suitable donor. But every so often, you come across an exceptional example. This is Alfin. He's Dawn and Angela's little boy, who's nearly a year old. But in 2009, when the couple decided they wanted to have a child, they were told they'd need to wait for up to 10 years for a suitable donor in their local area. They couldn't understand why there was such a long wait.
I'd like to ask why it's not so available. Why isn't there as many sperm donors? You know, it's not being able to have a child can really destroy a relationship and really destroy your life, because you can have failed fertility treatment or just not being able to get a donor or afford it, but you can't escape children. They're on the TV all the time, they're in the streets all the time. You know, it's everywhere you go, there's babies.
In their frustration, Dawn and Angela looked to Denmark and made several attempts with Danish donors. They found much more choice there, and that wasn't the only attraction.
It actually appealed to us a bit more in some respects, because we didn't have that worry of
you know, oh, well, what if they bump into a sibling and they don't know and things like that? There was a lot less chance of that.
I'm quite excited about getting a little Viking.
Yeah, I think you can see it.
Yeah, a little Viking.
It was just exciting because it was, you know, finally we were embarking on, hopefully, having a baby.
Although they did eventually find a UK donor through a private clinic, which led to Elfin being conceived, Dawn and Angela's experience shows how misinformation over waiting lists can play a part. But, as Alan Pacey explains, the shortage of donors remains the real issue.
In order to provide sufficient amounts of treatment to UK patients and also provide them with choice with regard to donor characteristics, we need about 500 donors in the UK per year. We still fall well short of being able to recruit 500. So the gap is filled by clinics importing sperm from other countries, and Denmark is one of those countries.
This is where the story really begins. I'm here on a busy shopping street in central Copenhagen. On one side there's a convenience store, on the other side there's an optician's, and behind us at the end of a passageway is a small, very unassuming door. There's no sign, you wouldn't know it, but this is actually the headquarters of the European Sperm Bank. We're going to go inside. The first thing I see is a room full of containers.
How many of these are there in here?
Large metal containers, a bit like milk churns.
Around 100.
100, and how many samples in each one?
Oh, that there first. And this one was only two. Mm-hmm. And this one, there's more, so that depends. That was a little bit.
The samples are kept frozen in these containers in liquid nitrogen at around minus 200 degrees Celsius.
It's amazing, in an office block like this from the outside, which looks so normal, you'd never imagine that all this was inside.
No.
Another unusual sight in here is that of a giant stuffed, fierce-looking polar bear who stands towering over the containers. They call him Bjorn.
It's part of the whole image about this is cold and frozen and a masculine place to work. It's felt like the right part. And then now he's getting a symbol for what we do and who we are.
The samples become so cold that they'll stay frozen for up to 2 weeks after they leave here. That's plenty of time for them to be flown out to dozens of different countries.
Everything goes out, so you see here it's lined up now.
So these are going all around the world, are they? That one's going to Brussels.
Oslo.
Helsinki. Oh, that one's going to the southwest of England.
Right. So these are all going out today? Yeah, everything goes out today.
Oh.
And delivered tomorrow.
And so this is a normal day, this level.
Now this is pretty much a normal ledger.
It's quite something.
And this is just one of two huge international sperm banks with premises in Copenhagen. Annemette Arndal Lauritsen heads the team of mainly female staff here.
This is the only thing we do. We don't do eggs, we don't do anything else. We just do sperm and sperm donation. And that gives us a possibility of being very focused on what we do.
It's certainly big business. 250 men regularly donate at this sperm bank alone. That's almost 10 times the number of registered donors in the whole of Scotland. And if you want to know what any of these 250 Danish donors are like, you just need to go online.
Caucasian, Scandinavian. Another one here is Caucasian German. One here is mixed, German, Scottish, Mexican, Italian. Then you go into the eyes, the hair color, the height and the weight. The education, like a business student, financial assistant, chemistry, business.
In the UK, you might not get much more information than that. But in Denmark, the depth of detail is incredible.
If you press this, you can actually hear the donor's voice.
What sort of things do they talk about? Are they talking about why they want to donate?
Some part is about their personality. What are they like? What are their family like? What are their favorite food, film, music, what do they do in the spare time, who do they choose as a friend.
Is that in English?
Yes, that's in English. And another thing you can look at, it's a baby photo. Here we start to record, all right, they have a mother and a father, how many siblings, and how many grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins.
A current photo is just about the only thing you don't get to see. That's in order to protect the donor's identities. John, that's not his real name, is in his 20s. He donates 3 times a week. He and others receive the equivalent of around €40 per visit, which amounts to several thousand euros a year. Although it's not a living, it's enough to make a substantial difference. But is it just about the money?
Well, the money is a big factor. I haven't got a lot of money, so I kind of need this money. But I think that I would be 10 times more happy about doing this if I actually could see some kind of reaction, some kind of payoff in the happiness in these people.
John is an open donor, so he can donate to the UK and might eventually meet some of the children born as a result. But for now, he says his main reason for donating is to help others.
It's a good purpose, and it helps people who cannot have children. And instead of like donating blood, you could do this instead and make people really happy.
Adam, his name's been changed as well, is now in his late 30s. He's married, but with no plans to have children with his wife. Money isn't the main factor driving him either.
I have a decent job, so I earn my own money. So it helps me with maybe a week or two in a holiday. So it's positive, but not the most important thing.
And how was the process? What was it like when you first came here? What happened?
I thought that I was going to have an interview and just some medical exams, but it was a very long and intense process. Blood samples, and then I had to fill out a lot of forms regarding my future, my family, if there was any disease in the family. They gather all my life together so they can have a full profile.
Only one in 20 men makes it through the rigorous selection process. Adam and John were delighted to be chosen, although, as John explains, not everyone's comfortable with the idea.
My parents think it's a bit weird. My father has said sometimes, like, so what am I supposed to do in 20 years when somebody comes knocking on my door and says, Grandpa? But I try to coach them and say that's probably not going to happen. And if it happens, it's not a bad situation, it might be a good thing.
It's the thought of these knocks on the door in 18 years' time that concerns some people back in the UK. Although each individual country can limit the number of families started by each donor, there's no collective limit worldwide. Laura Witjens is from the UK's National Gamete Donation Trust. She says that although a donor may be limited to 10 families in Britain, he could also have started families in many other countries too.
When you combined all these countries, you came to a very large number. And I'm sure that the donor would be shocked as well, because there's one thing of consenting to a number of children on paper, but if you actually get confirmation that you have 50 children, I'm not sure whether men like that actually. 50 children to have as offspring is quite quite a lot. I'm not saying it's a good or a bad thing, I just want to know whether they're open about that. And if not, why not, if they got something to hide?
At the European Sperm Bank, Annemette Arndal-Lauritsen insists nothing is hidden.
I think when they start being a donor with us, they have thought about this. They don't go into this with their eye closed. They have open mind. We have told them that this is worldwide and they know it, but they're also realistic.
What about actual numbers, though? I ask how many children each donor might produce, and at first, it's not clear.
I don't think there's a specific answer. It's not a sort of a number that is announced.
What sort of ballpark number are we talking
about? No, but there's no ballpark number that we are using for that.
So it could be hundreds.
It is not hundreds.
20s, 30s.
Eventually, I do get an answer.
Our donors, on average, have less than 25 pregnancies in average.
25 may be an average, but Sebastian Moore, who's interviewed dozens of donors for his research at the University of Copenhagen, talks about much greater figures.
Most men don't have a particular number in their mind. For all of them, it was, though, shocking to think about a number that was rather large. And here I'm talking about like 150 and more. Some of them were like, they are at least uncomfortable with the thought. But, I mean, sperm banks make money with sperm. We have to keep reminding ourselves of this.
It's very much more of a commercial operation, I believe. So if you've got a particularly fabulous donor on your books in your Danish sperm bank, the impetus would be, I would think, to keep him on the books, collect as much sperm as possible, and then dare I say, you're making money hand over fist.
Dr. Alan Pacey of the British Fertility Society. That said, the men I meet seem relaxed about the numbers.
Does it worry you how many children there might be? Is that something that concerns you?
No, not really. I can't really see if there's 100 children out there in 5 years who are half me, then I can't really see what the problem could be.
And not just relaxed, excited even.
It would be nice if there was 100, 200 in the same sample as me. I think it's a funny thought how many children I can make.
Do you ever get to find out whether people have got pregnant as a result of your donations?
No, I don't think so.
Is it something you'd like to know? Is it?
Sometimes, yes. Maybe it would be a great feeling to know that I actually have done something to help people.
My genetics are being spread all over the world without me having to do anything about it, which is a great thing, I think.
We've heard what John and Adam think, but of course, what we don't know is how the children conceived from Danish sperm will feel about it in the future, as they're still very young. In the UK, things have developed at a remarkable pace. In 2006, the country wasn't importing any Danish sperm, but by 2010, the most recent figures available, Denmark was providing around a third of the UK's total sperm imports, and the Danes are still recruiting donors.
I'm looking through the microscope and I can just see lots of tiny little, I suppose those are the tiny little sperm moving about down there, very fast, some not so fast. Is that a good sample?
It's an all right one. He's a potential donor, which means that he hasn't been approved. He's here for his first sample today. So basically what I've done is I've purified it and now I've tried to dilute it to see how much he can, how well he performed.
With the exception of one high-profile case, in which a donor passed on a rare genetic condition to several of the 43 children he produced, there's general agreement that the Danish system is safe and robust. As for the extraordinary amount of detail that's available online, well, some people have reservations about this. Joe and Sarah's son Ewan was created with the help of a Danish donor. Ewan's a very happy and healthy little boy, but before he was conceived, Sarah was almost put off the idea completely.
I was absolutely overwhelmed by the website. Lists and lists of donors with a flood of information. It felt so surreal to me because I'd always thought of having a family. I never thought of the commodity sperm, and it freaked me out.
To be fair, that whole side of the process to try and find out more information about the donor, that just doesn't concern me. What's important is that we start the process and that we have a baby at all.
I think that's why it freaked me out so much, because I hadn't really given it much thought. You're just thinking about getting a sample that will help you have a child, and then I thought, this is getting a face. It's becoming more close than I wanted it to be. I didn't really want to have those details. So it took me a while to get over that.
Although Joe and Sarah went through a clinic, not everyone does. And Ruth Wild from the British Infertility Counselling Association has some concerns about this.
Some sperm banks overseas will supply for home insemination, and that's a little bit of a worry because these people don't have access to any counselling at all and can import anonymous sperm rather than identity release sperm, storing up potential problems for their child in the future.
In 2013, one particularly alarming case came to light, that of a British woman who bought so-called DIY sperm from Denmark's other big sperm bank, Cryos, and used it to inseminate her 14-year-old adopted daughter. This is an extreme example of what can go wrong, and some people do still buy Danish sperm for home insemination. But it is lawful, at least within certain rules imposed by the European Tissue Directive. Even so, European Sperm Bank says it doesn't deliver directly to patients' doors in the UK. But then it doesn't need to. It's already exporting directly to fertility clinics across the country, many of which find it easier than recruiting their own donors.
What is, do you think, the attraction of Danish sperm for so many clinics and for so many patients?
Probably as much as anything, availability. The unit that we have dealt with mostly is accessible, it's been around for a long time, they're reliable, we have a relationship with them, which means that we don't have to set up new paperwork and everything every time that we want to import sperm. So it's relatively easy for us to say to people, look there first.
That's Jane Stewart, a consultant in reproductive medicine in the northeast of England. We still don't really have the answer to our original question. Why are so few men donating in the UK? Lara Witjens from the National Gamete Donation Trust said the current British system simply isn't geared towards recruitment.
It's much easier for a British clinic to order the sperm from Denmark and it's being FedExed the next day, which is much easier for a clinic than to try to recruit their own donors.
But Olivia Montuski from the British-based Donor Conception Network thinks the real problem lies with the clinics themselves and what they're not telling patients.
They are not told that actually there may be a clinic down the road in the UK that has a very good supply of UK recruited sperm donors.
Why would people not be told about them?
Because of the competition between clinics. Clinics like to retain their own patients. They don't like to share them with others, and they won't tell them. They contribute to the problem, if you like, by keeping that sperm to themselves. And so people in the UK have to know where those banks are in order to be able to find a UK donor.
Most people agree that if it's ever to catch up with the Danish sperm banks, the UK system needs to change. But how?
The change that I would love to see is having one central place where information about the availability of sperm and eggs was held. That's what we really need, is one central place.
We're actually proposing to run a national sperm bank under the wing of the National Gamete Donation Trust. The biggest thing is that we will guarantee an independence because we're not a clinic. We know that donors can be recruited. We've seen the issues, so the knowledge from Denmark would make a huge difference. The Danish model is a slick model. It's customer service driven. It really knows how to do well with donors, got a good website. And that's what we can do in the UK as well. It's not rocket science.
And after we recorded that interview with Lara Witjens, her proposal was accepted. The Department of Health has now awarded a grant to the National Gamete Donation Trust to provide the service, and the UK's National Sperm Bank is due to launch this month. In Denmark, at least, the system of having sperm banks separate from clinics seems to make a big difference. But is there something about the Danish psyche that Britain just doesn't have?
Well, if you went around the stereotypes, you might say, well, perhaps we're not very open about the discussions. And I think whether the Danish population are more open about it, I don't know. I don't know if there's any actual evidence of it, but you know, it's all part of the issue.
The Danes as a nation are much more open about talking about these issues and proud that they can produce the sperm. The Englishman, you know, it involves a sexual act. And so there's a bit of a smutty thing about it.
Is this part of a national identity, part of the Viking race or whatever? I think it was the Italian Vogue or something that had a coverage of the Danish sperm banks, and they had like a muscular guy with a Vikinger helmet on. It was like, this is not what they look like anyways. But there was no evidence in the interviews that the men saw themselves as part of a superior Nordic race that is trying to fertilize the whole world.
In the year 1014, a Danish Viking was briefly sitting on the English throne. Exactly 1,000 years later, a huge Danish warship returned to spend several months here in the British Museum as the centrepiece of a major Viking exhibition. Today, the Danes are supplying a growing proportion of donor sperm to the UK, leading to more and more pregnancies and babies. But are there any parallels to be drawn between what happened then and what's happening now? Alan Pacey again.
Denmark is geographically close to the UK. I think there's some kind of philosophical and intellectual bond that we have with Denmark. It's a bit like kind of the Viking invasion of the 800 AD. They've invaded us once by boat and now they're doing it by sperm. And I don't think we see that as half as frightening as we do
thinking about importing sperm from other parts of the world. So I really do think there's an interesting cultural thing going on here that is working at perhaps the subliminal level.
Is it the Danish compost of the world?
The second one after the Vikings? It's more like being able to help the women out there and being able to accomplish their wish of having a child with a donor that they have chosen themselves and giving them the best possible insight to make that choice.
Maybe I feel quite international, the international father. We're just helping you. I'm not thinking about the Vikings, so I think it should be a great help for you. In the UK, I think it's very good. So.
For Sarah and I, it will be very important to explain to Ewan and to take him to Denmark to see the Viking boats, and it's part of who he is. So, and we have to celebrate that and explain and educate him about that. I actually was in Denmark a couple of weeks ago, and I brought him back a little Viking hat to celebrate his Vikingness, which I don't think he was too impressed with in the beginning, but then he got used to.
The New Vikings was presented by me, Kate Bryan. It was produced by Steve Urquhart, and it's a Spark Lab production for the BBC World Service. Coming.